So today we've got a new concept, and I call it The Last Meal on Earth. And today we've got the actor Sean Douglas is going to tell us a little bit about his life, background, and more importantly for this podcast, his food tastes and potential dislikes. So we're going to start with the first question. I mean, effectively, if you could condense and have a summary of where you were born, how it was growing up, and where you're living now.
So I was born in a place called Portsmouth, city of Portsmouth on the south coast, which if people don't know, it's near the Isle of Wight. Most people recognise that. And I grew up in a suburb which is Bedhampton-Havant area. And funny enough, I've lived in London for a long time, and but I've gravitated back to this area now, so I'm back in Havant, really for cost of living wise. So that's where I'm at now. And do you want a little bit about my sort of like childhood and
Well, yes, I mean, the thing is that I suppose that dovetails into another question is sort of you must have seen markers growing up that actually made you think that you could go into an acting career either on the stage, TV or film.
Yeah, I think looking back, I mean, it was something I almost had to do. And I say that sounds a bit cliche, but you sort of, as a child, I realised at an early age, I was fascinated by the medium of television, particularly. I was very lucky I grew up, arguably, in the golden age of TV, sort of like the end of the 70s and sort of 80s, certainly with American television coming here, TV shows. But, very sort of brief history. My mother, unfortunately, for rightly or wrong, and it's not an issue at all. She was married, divorced when I was a baby, so I grew up with my grandparents and my mum, obviously there, and they had a lovely big bungalow with a huge garden, lots of animals, dogs and things. And I sort of grew up watching sort of westerns and things like this. And as a child, I was forever dressing up. And where I actually went to school in a different area. So when I'd come home from school, my friends were in a completely different area. So I was very much on my own. I'm an only child as well, which I was quite happy to be. But I would take the dogs off into the garden and I'd dress up with my little cowboy uniform and we'd just sort of act out these scenes. Didn't know what I was doing particularly, obviously, as a child, but it was very integral part of my childhood. And I think certainly from the television side and visually, I remember a particular time I begged my granddad to let me stay up and watch what was the Clint Eastwood film, The Fistful of Dollars, which was a huge film, obviously. And I remember sitting there, and I mean, apart from anything else, being sat with my granddad, which was a great thing. I could only have been probably about 5 years old, but I still remember it now. And sat there watching this film on a colour television as well, which was at the time, there wasn't a huge amount of those around. And watching this film and being absolutely blown away by it, you know, and it's still one of my favorite films now, arguably. And that moment then, I sort of thought to myself, wow, do you know, I sort of want to do this, whatever this thing, this box is that's giving me this information. I'd like to be on there and doing, and not sort of like being on TV. I was too young to understand that, but to be dressed up and have all these fabulous sets and everything around me. And that's probably where it all came from. And of course, at school, I was in, you know, the drama club and things like this and what have you. And, you know, did I played the Turkish Knight, for instance, in the nativity play and all these sort of things. It all kind of drops in, really.
So was that the first moment, or were there any other moments growing up where you cemented that you wanted to get into this industry?
I think the Clint Eastwood film, Fistful of Dollars, was probably the most poignant thing because that sort of set the seed, really. And from there was lots of other little things. Like I say, I was in school drama clubs and things like this, did shows as a child, and not a huge amount. I mean, I'm not from a theatrical background, quite the opposite. I came from a very normal working class family. And ironically, I had to go into a different career because I went to college. And again, it was a generation when, be perfectly honest, You couldn't really, I mean, you could have, but it would have just been laughed at. My parents would have just said, because my mum, I should say, my mum remarried when I was 9 years old and they moved out. And the dad that I have now, I consider my father, he's fantastic. I wouldn't pick anybody else, to be honest with you. So we moved out and obviously started a new life. I went to, carried on with school, everything, went to college. And it wouldn't have been really viable, but deep down then I knew, it's what I wanted to do. I was fascinated with music. I was very much, weirdly enough, I mean, we'll talk briefly about that, but when I was at college, I got very much into a group called Susan the Banshees and The Cure. I don't know if you're familiar with them.
Yes,
And
I'm
I used to
familiar with
dress up
you.
like Robert Smith. I had all the black spiky hair, eyeliner and the smudge lipstick, and you can imagine back in the 80s how that went down in sort of like colloquial little towns. So I remember I went on holiday with mum and dad, and they made me walk on the other side of the street because the people were stopping and going like this. They'd never seen what was, I suppose, a gothic kind of character. But I was, past that, with dressing up in this sort of thing and being, almost being this character, really. And that sort of stimulated it as well. But unfortunately, rightly or wrongly, it wasn't viable. When I was 18, I had to do what would be arguably proper qualifications. But deep down, I knew that's what I wanted to do. And it was always sort of, how do I get into this business?
Well, leading on from that, I mean, what are the next steps for somebody who wants to move and become either a professional actor or effectively a jobbing actor?
I think it's a very different time now. It's certainly far more, I mean, media is phenomenal. I mean, back in the time I was there was no internet, so it was very, very hard. Just from a personal thing, I mean, it'd be interesting just to compare what I had to do. So left college, some jobs and what, I've hated them, got fired from a couple of them because it just wasn't me. I felt very sort of out of my skin in an office. Didn't like it at all. And I thought to myself at a young age, and I'm sure many young people will, even now, will probably sort of certainly sympathize with this, and more than likely empathize as well, that I just felt it was all wrong. I was doing something wrong with myself. So kind of long story short, I ended up making sort of my own business, which was in civil engineering, because I had some sort of form of control. And kind of long story short, I worked in that for about 9 years and effectively made enough money that I could go, get out of this. I sold the business off, and don't get me wrong, it wasn't hundreds of thousand pounds. It was probably about £40,000 I came out with, which was a good amount of money at the time, with a view that I could go, right, okay, I'm going to try and do what I've got to do to go to into the acting industry. And to sort of explain how I did that, and this is how crazy it was, again, no internet at the time, I literally picked up a yellow pages, which some people might not even know what a yellow pages is. And I went through there and looked for acting. And a lady came up as a voice coach called Eileen Norris. And I was like, well, do you know what? I'll ring her up. And I rang this lady up, and she was lovely. And she said, so what's your background in it? I said, apart from, as I've just explained to you, Martin, very, very little. I don't know what I'm doing. And she said, look, come in. I'm a voice coach. We'll look at some monologues, things like this. And this all was new words to me. I didn't know what a monologue was particularly. So great. So obviously went to see Eileen and paid her and what have you. And she was fabulous. And she said, look, you need to go the way the business went, you need to go to a drama school. But there's a fantastic college around the corner, because she said, you're going to struggle to get into a mainstream drama school at your level. You just don't have the background. And I was sort of latter 20s, and I would have been about 26. So she said, you're going to be up against loads of 18-year-old kids that have been doing this for God knows how long. And I'm like, okay. So she said, what you need to do is try and get into, there's an intensive acting course at the Chichester College. Try and get in there. I'll give you sort of like the background, some monologues to work, and you'll have to audition. And I was terrified by all this. I was like, audition, my God, it all starts to come in then. What being an actor is really about, So we worked on these piece of Shakespeare and a contemporary play, and I managed to get an interview and go up and see an audition with a lovely guy called John Dryden, who I'm still sort of vaguely in touch with via Facebook, who was the director of this school. He said, yes, I'd like to offer you a place. I was over the moon. And I went back to the partner at the time, the lady I was with, and said, Just to let you know, the business is going to stop. I've always wanted to do this, as you
Yeah.
know. I've got myself in. I didn't tell anybody, I didn't tell my mum and dad. I just thought I'm going to do this on my back, because I was terrified, to be perfectly honest. You know, it was completely alien to me. Never sort of worked in that industry at all, apart from being fascinated by film and TV, and literature and things like this. That was my only sort of go to. And then so I said, well, this is what I'm going to do. I start in September. And so I went on this intensive acting course and did pretty well on it, I have to say. I did some a Lander examination, which was very successful. I was sort of cast as a lead in one of their sort of major projects at a local theatre, the Watershed in Bognor Regis. And really, all the time I was there, John was saying, you need to go to a professional drama school, which is an NCDT recognised one, really, which is, and there's probably about, I guess probably about 19 of them. So you then obviously post off and say, you want to audition for these places. You have to pay for that. So it's all acting can be quite expensive. This is all hopefully helpful to people that are trying to look at it now. You do need some money behind you, unfortunately. There are scholarships and things, but it's very, very hard. And so I actually auditioned for seven, and I was very lucky to actually be offered three. And I picked the one that I wanted to go to, which was the Arts Educational Schools in Chiswick in London. I didn't particularly need to go to London. I was quite keen on RSAMD actually in Scotland, but I went all the way through, but didn't make the last hurdle. So they didn't want me, unfortunately. So I chose to go to Arts Ed. And from there, it was like obviously 3 year training at professional drama school. So to answer your question back on that sort of
Yes,
how I
yes,
sort
yes.
of got to arguably a level of calling yourself a professional actor after the training and what have you. I mean, the modern world, I think you certainly need some money behind you. It's not the be all and end
Yeah,
all.
yeah.
I would certainly say try and do it when you was as young as possible, but you need some life experience as well. I mean, it's different for everybody. You've got to know yourself really where you're at. I don't know that I would have been ready to go to drama school when I was 18. Be honest with you, it's a very different time now. I think people are
Yes.
certainly more worldly because of the internet and things like this, rightly or wrongly, I don't know. But yes, so an 18-year-old now would probably be the same sort of level of maturity that I had when I was maybe 25. So it was probably the right time for me to go to drama school. But certainly the younger, the better. Again, be careful with drama schools because I'm looking at now, where I'm at now is doing some retraining because I don't get to work as an actor as much as I would like. That's the nature of being a jobbing actor. I have an agent, but I have to do work outside of it. And your tools, it's hard to keep your tools honed all the time if you're not doing it. And again, I've moved out of London now. Because of basically cost effectiveness, I live about 1 hour and 15 minutes away. But moving outside of London, you don't have to be in London, but certainly you need. It's far more helpful to be in those sort of cities. Liverpool's very good, Bristol's very good. London's excellent. Parts of Wales, there's film, theatre, TV going on. Just because you're having those conversations and you're mixing with people, where I live now, it's hard work. This is probably the most interesting conversation I'll have for the next maybe 2 months.
Well, I mean, I know that it takes a lifetime. You're always trying to master the skill of acting
It's a
because
journey.
lots of
It is a journey.
it's always a journey, but how many years does it take you before you really got recognized as an actor, where you would go in for a role and they'll say, right, you've got enough experience to carry it forward?
It's a weird one because, again, I mean, back on what I was saying then, it's very much the beauty of acting. It's quite brutal in a way. You go on your day for your casting or what have you, whatever you're doing, your interview, your meeting, and it's on you. And if you sort of don't come up to scratch on that, you're not going to get the job. And certainly with commercial work, and sub TV work is quite commercial sort of oriented. I'm not talking about advert commercials. I mean, just sort of that kind of low budget television. It can be very much, you can walk in there and your eyebrows don't look right, and you won't get the job.
So on
You won't
that
you get
point, How much do you believe that it's a v visual, and how much is the craft marked? I mean, would you have a particular ratio? I mean, not sort of specifically, but in your experience of going for roles.
It's very hard to really give an objective view on that because as an actor, you're not ever really told. I've never had a casting director tell me at the end of a casting or an interview or a meeting and say, I'm not going to give this to you because your agent rarely finds out
Yes,
as
yes,
well.
yes, yes.
So you don't honestly know. You can kind of feel yourself when it's gone well. We'll get a brief. Your agent, hopefully, or if you don't have an agent, you'll see whatever the job advertised on the spotlight, or if you use other forums, there's lots of websites that offer acting work. Unfortunately, the mainstream acting, you kind of need to be with an agent for that now. It's always been that way, to be honest with you. So you kind of get a vibe that you think, yeah, I've nailed this, which is a weird, but there's no rhyme and rhythm to that. Again, because it could be very much. I mean, if the role's very particular, the brief says that they want someone. I mean, I had a classic years ago. My agent sent me to a casting, and the advert was quite particular. And her brief was they wanted a bald man. Well, I'm not bald. I shaved my head, and she sent me. And I walked in the car. She goes, "Why are you here?" And I said, "Well, I've been, my agent." She said, "But I want a bald man. You know, I told these. They keep sending me these people with hair." And I felt I was saying, "Yeah, but I." And I thought, well, no, I can see what you're saying because I actually saw the advert and they needed to do almost like a fake tattoo across the head. So
Oh,
you
okay.
actually had to be physically bald. And this is one of those where you went in and you thought, oh, gosh, here we go, sort of thing. So it is difficult. It's hard to get that gauge. You've got the brief. So you hopefully work within that. And it will be quite specific in a way, but equally, it can be very, very sort of open. And I don't really, I've got, a lot of my friends are actors. I mean, most of my friends, because from drama school and working, most of my friends are actors and what have you. And most of them, ironically, do a lot of comedy work. And I've had friends of mine that have said they've been to castings and the brief is so vague that you're told, oh, this is sort of what we're. And then you, obviously, as an actor, you're quite creative, hopefully. And they create these scenes for them and what have you and go away and they don't get the job. And then ironically, they see the advert back and they have literally plagiarized. They've taken what my friend has actually given them in the casting and used that in their advert. And you're like, wow, really? So that it's a very weird kind of sort of process almost. And I think, I can't remember the actor's name. He was an English actor years ago and sort of TV actor. Then he said that he only started getting work when he stopped worrying about it. And there's a lot of truth on that as
Well, I
well.
mean,
When you
it's a
stop
bit like
caring.
most things. When you're interviewing for a role, they can see your fear on your face. And then, I mean, a number of people that I've known, if they don't care that they get the role, they get the role, which is a bit ironic, isn't it?
Yeah, I think there's an
So,
awful. It's not sort of you come across as needy. I think it's just one of those that if you go and it's almost like an arrogance. But weirdly enough, it projects itself in a way that people go, "Well, you must be pretty good then, because you're not too worried about this role, subject to what
well,
it is." But equally, I don't
I,
like that because
yeah.
I want to go to castings and be, I'm very keen. I normally go to things that I'm actually genuinely interested in. And you want to come across as like, you really want this sort of thing. So it's a weird sort of physical dynamic, vocal, mental dynamic. It's a battle, you're trying to get sell yourself in all the right ways, obviously, because you want that
Well,
job.
you want to come over as relaxed and to have the correct timings, I would expect. And when if you're,
Certainly
you
for
have that
comedy,
urgency and you're going to be taught, so that's not really how you want to come across, unless that is the role that you're going for. So, I
Well,
mean,
to
which
answer your initial part of that question, because it's one of those that most of these would just open up a book, obviously. It's for me, I'm a very physical orientated actor, and quite visually motivated. Sorry, my cat's just got out of bed and come in, so I apologize if you can hear him mewing in the background. You probably jump on my lap now. So So yeah, certainly to say my comedy actors, it's very much their timing, everything up physicality and that. But for me, what I'm looking at is probably more, I tend to get offered more sort of like physical roles and the way I sort of I present myself physically. Obviously I've gone back to the shaven head, it's a particular kind of look. So for me, I'd say the ratio is probably 80% that and 20%, maybe vocal dialogue, what have you. However, say for a comedy act, it could be completely different. It's very, very much, it's a personal thing,
Yes,
and there's
same.
no right and wrong. This is the worst thing. You go in, you hit some of them. I mean, I did EastEnders. I knew I'd got that as soon as I walked out because I got on very well with the casting director. He was
Yes,
lovely, really nice guy, and the director there as well. And they were looking for someone that had a bit of swagger and that kind of sort of like rough villain. I mean, I played a guy that was in prison, obviously. I was sort of like a get out clause for one of the actors who was leaving the show. So I was part of his storyline. And straight away, I thought this feels right. I mean, there's limited dialogue, much TV is, which is great. So it was more about the physical, the presence. And they clearly, I realized that I needed to be sort of an intimidating character. So that was really 80% physical and 20% dialogue, And you have to make those choices and sort of decisions. And I think most casting directors want you to make a strong choice, even if it's wrong, go in with conviction, and offer that because they want to see something. And they might end up completely redirecting you, which is fine. And then obviously you've got to adapt to that. But if you go in there, you're a little bit kind of like unsure what you're doing and you're going to struggle with it, But equally,
So,
you're not really going to know unless you get a job or not.
do you read the cast and actually change your demeanor depending on the cast that you're filming at that particular moment? Or do you still go out with that particular character? Because you may
Well,
need
it's
to
very
kind
much, I
of
mean,
smooth it.
when you're on, you talk about when you've got the job. Or, yeah,
When you
so
got
when
the
you've
job,
actually been cast, I mean, the director will, you'll get an idea of what they're after. So we use the EastEnders because EastEnders is a fascinating thing. The turnover is huge on there, obviously. So it's very, very limited. And what you can do rehearsal wise, I mean, so mine was quite small, a very small part on there. It was, say, Matt D'Angelo was leaving the series. He was going off to Strictly Come Dancing. So the storyline was that he was going to end up in prison. And he sort of met me in transit through the court system. And all we could do was literally run the lines. The first AD came into the green room and we were sat there chatting. I was, do you want to just run your lines? And so I did them with Matt then. So there's no real sort of like real rehearsal. You just sort of do that. And then you go on set, and then you do it. And interesting enough, the final sort of scene is I'm in a cell, and Matt is like frog marched in by this guard and put into my cell. And then I look at him and say my line and what have you. And it's obviously it's intimidatory and what have you. And I said it to such a level that he was, oh my God, he just came out of character. He said it's like working with Al Pacino. And the director said, look, just take it down. He said, you look scary enough. You don't just literally say the line, because obviously I gave it a little bit of, energy and gusto, so to speak. So that was kind of how it worked then. So obviously, yes, I did go in there with a view of like I'm gonna be, but it was too big. It was too big for in the director's sort of opinion. So I had to sort of rein it right back and just literally say the line. A fairly neutral level because, again, visually, he got what he wanted from it. And there's all this business going on. Certainly, this is why I love camera work. It's arguably, I think I've always been drawn more to film and TV than theatre. I've enjoyed theatre. I mean, I was theatre trained, but it's a very different medium. Again, most of the roles I did sort of a theatre were physical orientated, physical theatre sort of thing, stage combat, those kind of things. I'm trained in stage combat. And but with the camera, it's very, very specific. It really doesn't lie, and I enjoy that sort of finite sort of detail. And you can offer things, and the director comes in, no, I don't like that. It's rubbish. Or can you try this and do? And then you've got things to work with. So the rehearsal process, certainly with those kind of shows where it's very limited, the amount of time, the money that costs to make these shows is phenomenal. It's very much sort of like almost on the fly, work in progress there. Whereas theatre, you've got, and theatre's changed an awful lot now. You used to get sort of like a month of rehearsal. You're lucky to get probably a week now. And it's a shame with rep theatre was fabulous, but sadly those days have sort of died a little bit, where you would obviously perform in the evening, but you'd be rehearsing the next show, sort of during the day. Yeah,
So,
so.
I mean, we've been talking a lot about sort of EastEnders. Is there any particular role or character that you like playing the most? And is there a role that you've got that you couldn't wish to actually leave,
Yeah, I mean,
because
how
maybe
long have you
you've
got,
been
Martin?
miscast
How long have you got? It's
or.
well, weirdly enough, I mean, it's interesting because I think I've always been fascinated with what makes actors. When people are interviewed, I'm more interested not so much about the film that they're in, about their backgrounds and everything, and how they tick, really. I find that fascinating. And so when I was at drama school, obviously I went to RZ, and I was a lot younger, had hair and everything. I was pretty much always cast. Sorry, I've got cat fur all over my nose. I keep stroking my nose. He's on my lap at the moment. So
Yes.
I was pretty much always cast as like almost romantic leads, those kind of characters, the sort of archetypal hero character. I
Yes,
played
yes.
Perseus and things like this, which was great. It was lovely. But I started to realize that I wasn't really interested in that because I found them not two dimensional, but you're very limited what you can do with those sort of roles because you're governed by the script, because a
Yes,
good
yes.
guy is a good guy. And I thought, I want to play villains. I thought villains are far more interesting. And consequently, I mean, when I came out of drama school, I went off and I did a sort of like a bit of rep Shakespeare Company, Cambridge Shakespeare Company, which is a fantastic experience. That was probably arguably my first sort of real job that I had outside of it. And I was cast as what was the Salads in The Merchant of Venice, which is Salanio, Salerio, and Salarino. They cut the three characters together. And I had that kind of sort of almost a bit like Brad Pitt kind of look, all the hair spiky, glasses, all this from Fight Club, which was great for that role. And then the next show that we did afterwards was a Macbeth, and I played Banquo. And the director said, "Would you everyone be happy, apart from the women, obviously, shave their heads?" And I said, "Yeah, no problem. I've always enjoyed creating characters. It's so I shaved them, and this look, and it was I just thought, wow, and that sort of opened up really. So I started then finding a way, like a niche with villainous characters, and moving it on when I was sort of out of work as a proper acting work, if you want to call it that. I worked at the London Dungeon, which is a fabulous experience. And I probably learned more about physical theatre in the London Dungeon. It's the old London Dungeon, the one that was at Tooley Street, not
Yes,
the
yes.
new one now, than I ever did at drama school, arguably, with that. It was a phenomenal experience because you had it's changed an awful lot now, unfortunately. Sadly, it's become very much a push button show. So they have actors there, but they're sort of the scripts are all predetermined. You've got very little scope to sort of move in and out. You're basically like robots, which is terrible for actors. And but back at when I was there, you went into this environment and you could literally you were given small tableaus to create your own character, and an audience would come in, and it was up to you. Obviously, you had parameters you had to follow, but it was up to you to create your own little show. And they had what was called Ripper Street there. And I've always been fascinated by the Jack the Ripper thing. So I managed to sort of create these shows, which were, I know they were really fantastic because I had people almost in tears, were terrified because the set was round you and everything. It was phenomenal. It really was. And that's when I started to realize that this is really where I want to go with acting. I want to play these sort of roles all the time. So to answer your question about what sort
Yes,
of
yes.
roles would I like to play, definitely I prefer the sort of villain roles. I would love to. I'm fascinated by sort of gothic horror. I've grown up with that as well. All the Hammer horrors, Chris Lee, Peter Cushing, love those guys. Yeah, fantastic. Dracula or a vampire would probably be top of the list for me. And I'm a big fan of Shakespeare, love Shakespeare. And again, the darker roles, I would love to play Iago from Othello as well. Extremely Machiavellian villain. It's fascinating, really. It's got shivers going down my spine thinking about him now. It's and I saw it was really, really interesting. When I was at drama school, I went and saw Stephen Burkoff at the Haymarket doing what he I think his show was called Shakespeare's Villains. And he did Iago then. It was phenomenal. And I love Stephen Burkoff as well. Really, really interesting. And it was sort of monologues from all sorts of Shakespeare sort of villains. And just his take, and he put spin on them as well. Not the traditional sort of has to be RP or this received pronunciation sort of it. And it was like, oh, God, this is fantastic. It really sort of made it believable and like real characters for me. So Iago would be top of the list as well.
And then, what strengths do you bring to a role, or if you are being cast for a role, what strengths would you portray, and what are your sort of elements that you need to work upon in the future to actually attain the relevant roles that you want?
I think strengths wise would be physicality, and it's difficult to comment because obviously you need feedback as an actor to get that. I've been told that my voice is interesting. I have range. I have a variety sort of accents. Although arguably in the modern world, sadly for actors, it's not really necessarily a good thing anymore. If they want someone with a Liverpudlian accent, they generally get someone from Liverpool now, whereas back in the day, you would create this accent and do your homework and what have you and voice coach. So yeah, I mean, visually, I think I've naturally got that kind of intensity, that sort of look. What from a professional point of view, I was bringing to the stage and certainly to a rehearsal process, that kind of desire to, work hard and that intensity again. What do I need to work on is being seen more, I think, having more work. It's one of those jobs that, you've got to be out there because generally work begets work as well. And it's very, very hard. I mean, I sort of regret in a way moving out of London, but unfortunately it was just so expensive. And like many actors, I think most sort of actors end up giving up, which is sad, but it's just that's not going to change. It's the nature of the beast because you don't get the regular work unless you're one of the very small percentage that are very lucky. And most people make their own luck. So it's not a sort of, oh, they're lucky and I'm not. It's just one of those. There's no rhyme and rhythm to that either. So it's tough. It's tough what to work on. I mean, I have an agent. I've always felt, it's very difficult with agents because they're trying to make a living as
Of
well.
course, yes.
There's only a certain amount of work that comes their way. And also, particular cast directors go to particular agents. So if you're not with that one of those agents, you're not going to get seen for those roles. It's not my agent's fault. It's the way that works as well. It's very hard. I mean, what do I do? Change an agent? Don't know. I'm very, very fond of my agent as well. But I've felt for a long time I'm not being seen for the sort of things that I would naturally probably walk into and have a good shot at. So for instance, because of my background, the physicality, this sort of villainous look now, I tend to play sort of like historical characters as well. I'm an extremely competent horse rider. I'm trained in stage combat, martial artist. I should have been seen for something like Game of Thrones. Didn't get seen for it. My agent couldn't get me in there because she obviously wasn't talking to the right sort of casting directors, those sort of things. So it's very hard to sort of turn around and say, what do I need to do? I can't really work anymore on my physicality, vocally, I'm trained, stage combat, all this. So I don't know what the answer is really. It'll either happen or it doesn't. The agent I was with at the time when I did EastEnders, he said, I'm amazed it hasn't happened for you. And that's just, I mean, how do you answer that question? It's and what is it to happen for you? It's, I mean, what is that? What, to be rich and famous? I think if you're in acting for that, that's a losing battle. I'm in it to work and do the roles that I find really interesting, like playing a vampire, like being Dracula, like playing Iago, something like that, like playing Jack the Ripper. I love sort of that kind of thing.
Didn't they let you give Mummy a kiss goodbye? Cheers, Alia. Please sit on, I'll bring what we call an insider to have a little chat with you. Give you some tips, sort of survival guide. You're not on your own tonight either. I'll put you in with another newbie. Keep you company.
Oh, great. It's the mummy's boy.
Right, so we've talked a lot about your background as an actor, but who have you worked with who has inspired you, and you've picked some tips off, and you would like to work with again?
There's a few, actually. Funny enough, back on the London Dungeon thing, I'd met a guy there who became a very good friend of mine. We don't see each other that much these days, unfortunately, because he's extremely busy, Hollywood and things like that now. But a guy called Matt Berry, a comedian, he's done tons, and very, very funny guy, fabulous, very inspirational, writes a lot of his own work. I've appeared in one of his actual shows called ADBC, and he's, brilliant. Very, very good guy. Very, very funny as well. Very genuine, interesting. And I'd love to work with Matt again somewhere along the line. Most famous people would probably be, I did a film called Inkheart a few years ago, which is a New Line Cinema production at Shepperton Studios. And I worked with the likes of Helen Mirren, and she was fantastic as well. Really, really nice. Extremely professional. Brendan Fraser, Paul Bettany. Most of my scenes were with Paul Bettany. He was really interesting guy as well. I'd love to work with Paul Bettany again. Reminds me, I remember seeing him in a film called Gangster Number One and was blown away by his performance. I think that was the one that kind of sort of made him in a way. He did quite a lot of stage work as well, but certainly mainstream wise. And he had that intensity and the similar sort of kind of actor that I am. And it was really nice working with someone like that. I learned a lot from him. Very, very physical, extremely focused, and an interesting guy to talk to as well. But ultimately, the reason I took the job, because it was sort of like a glorified extras role, really, and I was sort of like, they contacted me for it. And it developed when I was on set, because I worked with the assistant director there was a guy called Tommy Gormley. He was an amazing fella. And he's sort of moved on from there and does most of the Mission Impossible films. He's a producer now. But he said to me one day, he came back on the set and he said, oh, the principals and the director, Ian Sopley, were watching The Rushes last night. And they said, who's this guy, East? And I said, well, you do know I'm an actor, don't you? He said, yeah, I did know that. The reason I took the job is where I'm getting around to the most famous and the person I would love to work again with would be Andy Serkis. I was effectively one of his sort of like sidekicks in it. Mm-hmm. And when I was told that I'd be working with Andy Serkis, I said, yeah, I want to do this. Mm-hmm. And phenomenal, because he obviously finished playing Gollum, Lord of the Rings, New Line Cinema as well. This was a New Line Cinema production. Unfortunately, it was supposed to be three films, but it just didn't take very well. And it was interesting just from how the industry works as well. We did a lot of scenes that didn't make the final cut, and that was down to, and they were quite dark. I mean, the book is quite dark in itself. It's by a lady called Cornelia Funke. And she wrote these three books. And at the time, they were supposed to be sort of like picking up where J.K. Rowling had finished with sort of Harry Potter. That was that kind of fantasy world. And again, I think they'd actually bought these three with a view to make these three films. But we did these scenes and they were quite sort of dark, children's fantasy film, but it was at that level, which I think most kids love. But the final edit was very, very sort of almost low key, and these scenes didn't make it, and it was their choice, obviously, in the edit and what have you. And it became a very sort of like more of a, if you like, a PC family, this kind of woke thing again. Yes. And it just didn't do well. It bombed at the box office. It was, I think, the budget was £96 million, and I don't think it made anywhere near the sort of money, the expectation. So they binned the following two, which was a shame, but obviously that was the way it was. But working with Andy Serkis, again, he'd come out of obviously playing Gollum, and the focus and the attention to detail, the physicality, that was phenomenal. And of course, all we ever said to him is, do some Gollum. And all he just goes, that was just priceless in itself. I would have done it for free. Honestly, yeah. I would have done that job for free just to work with him. So yeah, to work with Andy Serkis again would probably be top of the list.
And then if you had the full spectrum of TV, film, theatre, who would be the actor that you'd want to work with?
I've been a big fan of Brad Pitt, always. I think as a young actor, I always felt sorry for him because he was very much cast on, I mean, he's a phenomenally looking bloke, there's no denying that. And I think as a young man, I sort of modelled myself a little bit on that, had the haircut and everything. And certainly as a young actor, I was training martial arts all the time, kickboxing. I taught kickboxing in London for the PKA and sort of went for that kind of Tyler Durden physicality, the look, you know, sort of looked like that as well, had the hair and everything. But I think he's very underrated as well. I mean, I remember watching a film called California with David Duchovny and Juliette Lewis. I don't think you've ever seen that film.
No, I haven't.
And he plays this character called Early Gray and he's a psychopath. And it's, I think Brad Pitt cameos have been brilliant. Then you see that he really is a good actor and he doesn't get the opportunity because, again, the business side of it, you know, he's a lead good looking man. They're obviously pushing him forwards because that's the money for them. Clearly, he's got his own company now, a production company, so he can push a little bit. But certainly when he was younger, he wouldn't have been able to do that. Brad Pitt, I'd love to work with someone like that, really. And again, because I just love the films and arguably not the best actor in the world, but he does a good job, you know. I mean, his stage presence, his stage work. Tom Cruise, I'd love to be in Mission Impossible. I mean, who wouldn't?
Wouldn't anybody?
That's just genius, that sort of thing. I mean, a bit kind of sort of, you know, again, young boy fantasy sort of stuff. But I think as an actor, you know, I've retained that sort of youthful sort of zest and desire to always do that. I mean, the body obviously is getting older now, so can't do the things it used to. But those are the sort of movies I would love to be in, and those actors are doing that sort of stuff. So naturally, I would like to work with those sort of guys, you know.
Yes, I mean, the franchise, every new movie, it's just moving forward at an incredibly pace with the technology and CGI and so forth.
He does all his own stunts still. That's phenomenal. Yeah. Someone of his age. I mean, you can't knock the guy. You know, he still looks fantastic. Yeah. And he's doing these ridiculous stunts. It's, you know, credit to him. And arguably, I mean, his acting and whatever. I mean, I've enjoyed most of Tom Cruise's work, you know. And same with Pitt as well. I mean, I've enjoyed Brad Pitt's work. Even some of the films that are clearly pushed towards that sort of agenda. But if you actually sort of look at some of the lesser sort of, well, not lesser projects, but the smaller roles, for instance, Jeffrey Doynes in 12 Monkeys, fantastic in that. Have you ever seen 12 Monkeys?
I have watched 12 Monkeys.
Great. You know, and Brad, you're like, wow, that's Brad Pitt. Yeah. And True Romance as well. He plays the stoner on the sofa. That's a great, you know, it's tiny little roles. And he's really, you just see that side of Brad Pitt. So, and of course, he's at that level where you think it would be phenomenal. I'd love to go and have a, you know, get in a pub with Brett and have a really good drink and heart to heart with him. But there's many, many actors like that. I'd love to have worked with Robert De Niro when he was younger, not so much now, but, you know, his film, Deer Hunter, still blows me away. I've probably grown more to enjoy Al Pacino as he's got older. There's sort of been a swap there. I was very much a De Niro fan when he was younger. Mm-hmm. And not so much Pacino, whereas gone the other way now, interestingly enough. And Pacino plays those roles that I just love. I mean, Devil's Advocate, playing the devil in that. I mean, God, what a role that was. I'd love to have played that. Never been able to do it as well as Pacino, mind you. But, you know, those sort of roles. I mean, De Niro was fabulous in Angel Heart as Louis Cipher, who was, again, the devil in that. Those sort of cameo roles, fantastic. You know, working with people like that in those sort of productions would be amazing. I think it was on most actors just, you just dream of. You know, you really do.
So I suppose being a jobbing actor. I mean, what are the benefits of doing that? Because normally people have a mundane 9 to 5 job, which they don't really like.
Yep,
But
I have to do that as well. Yeah.
I mean, from my perspective, it seems that you have a sort of a career or a life where you have that sprinkle dust. So it sort of removes you from reality. I
I
mean,
think that's what keeps you going because the art, sadly, reality is pretty banal, isn't it? It's, I
yes, yes.
think, most actors, you've got to be careful because obviously you don't want to live in a complete fantasy world. I mean, there's a great film with Niall and I don't know if you've ever seen that at all, and it's
Yes,
quite
yes.
clever what it does because it's based a little bit on fact. What happened, you know, with these two, because it's written by the guy that actually he went into the Romeo and Juliet film, played Benvolio, and his friend is very much based on the other character that you see this crumble, you know, and that's so there's a fine line between yes, you want to be immersed in. I mean, look behind me, I surround myself in fantasy.
Yes.
I'm very into video gaming. Which is escapism again. You know, I read those kind of books, Lord of the Rings, those sort of things. I love horror film, fantasy horror films, my favorites, really. So I'm always surrounded, but I have to go in the real world and I have to earn a living as well. And as a jobbing actor, there's very few actors make that sort of money all the time.
Yes,
It's a very
yes.
small percentage. I think
I mean,
Equity did some years ago, which is very interesting. And whatever they did, they got a computer and they bunged all the sort of professional actors, so on the spotlight, into this melting pot. So it was the likes of Brad Pitt, Cruise, down to jobbing actors like myself and whatever, maybe even student actors. And they put them into this melting pot and worked out that for any year, you're lucky to work more than 10 weeks as a professional actor. And that includes the people that are working all the time of any year, which is basically 2 months. And that's terrifying. And it also brings it home that unless you can afford to sit at home and do the things that you would like to do as an actor when you're not working, physical training your voice, this writing, all
Yes,
this,
yes.
you have to go out and get a real job as well. And that can kill you as an actor as well. You know, it's just the time.
Well, I mean, that leads into the next section, which is talking about your hobbies, what you do to relax and remove yourself from
Drinking
the
tea.
world.
Drinking tea, that's my
Well, I
hobby to
suppose
relax.
drinking tea relaxes yourself and is good for the
Very
vocal
much.
cords, isn't it? So, I mean, you have alluded to some of your hobbies. I wonder if you could expand some of your hobbies and your interests.
Sure.
Maybe sort of do be a little bit laser focused on some certain aspects.
Definitely, yeah. So a big hobby of mine, basically because it's easy, is for me to sort of sit here because money's an issue. I have to be careful while I spend my money. So I do enjoy video gaming, and also it's a medium for actors. So I find it phenomenal as well. But I'm the big video gamer now. I've played on both Xbox and PlayStation, and the sort of games that I like are generally sort of like challenging ones. I do like things like Dark Souls and Sekiro and those sort of games, the Elden Ring, which is from Software. They're probably my favorite, but equally I'm quite happy. I enjoy a bit of multiplayer, so I love GTA when it comes out. GTA 6 I'm looking forward to. Rockstar games, I mean Rockstar are phenomenal, the stuff they produced, although I was a bit disappointed with Red Dead Redemption 2. But yeah, so those sort of things. I love video gaming. I play online with my friends, other actors as well, because it's a very easy thing for us to sit on. You can get into co-op parties and chat with people and what have you. And of course, it's a visual thing, and it's fantasy again, escapism, create characters, arguably in a way. And it's a huge, huge industry now.
So effectively, you put the mic on, and then you can effectively escape as a character
Yeah,
when you're playing
yeah,
the game. I mean,
yeah. Literally, Martin. I'm in my flat. I mean, I've got my cat, so I look after him. And I will draw the curtains, block the world out, get it nice and dark in here, and slap on one of these video games. And I can lose 6 to 8 hours on there, obviously with a tea and a loo break. But yeah. I find that they're incredibly immersive. You know, there's so much detail to them. So that would be a big hobby for me. I also, I mean, I'm just hide away in the flat. I'm a very, very competent and keen horse rider, but I don't, again, it's incredibly expensive. So as an actor, you're always looking at your budget, you know, this is the thing.
Yes.
So I don't get to do that as much as I would like. I like to fish, freshwater fishing. I don't get to do that as much as I like because it's expensive again. So this is one of the things you say about youngsters as actors, you've got to be realistic about it. You know, you really do. It can cost you a lot of money just to sort of put yourself out there. There's an awful lot of work that has to be done for free. It doesn't have to be done for free, but you kind of need to build a profile and you meet
Yes.
people. So, you know, you've got to have that sort of money behind you to keep yourself going in a way. And when you get paid work, it's lovely. You do get paid pretty well, I have to say. But that doesn't necessarily come all the time. You know, that's the thing. So those are sort of major. I enjoy cycling as well. I've got a mountain bike and try and get out on that when I can. I enjoy going to the pub with my friends. Funny enough, I've organised a pub crawl. I'm old school. You're probably the same. I love going out early in the day and literally going out until about 7 o'clock, and we do a pub crawl. So we go around lots and lots of different pubs. So I enjoy that social thing. And I've arranged one for this Saturday, funny enough, for the place that I work part time at the moment. Some of the people there. So that's always nice. Yeah, I'm reading, you know, film, TV, I watch Up Together. I'm not a traditional, I've never been interested. I'm a bit anti-BBC these days, the way they've gone, because I just find it garbage on there. So I don't pay a TV license. So what I tend to do is, and they're aware of that, I buy stuff when I want to see it.
Yeah,
So
that's right.
I think a lot of people have come round to that now because I've never, even as a child, I wouldn't just sit there and watch what was ever on the idiot box. You know, I
No,
just didn't turn
nor do I.
and watch and zone out. I would look at a timetable or get TV and look at the stuff that I wanted to watch. Shows like Twin Peaks when it was on. I'd make Tuesday nights was Twin Peaks, you know, had to sit there and watch that. So, but yeah, film, TV, I go to the cinema when I can. Those sort of things, really. My cat is a huge hobby, as you can probably tell. I mean, he's my baby, so.
So, turning away from the visuals, I mean, should we talk more about the audio? So, I mean, effectively, what sort of music do you listen to solo? And do you have a different playlist if you're with other people?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I've got quite a mixed background. It's almost like acting in as much as I've gone through very, I mean, I was very lucky when I grew up, is it fashion was still a big thing. So, I mean, we do a bit of a timeline. When I was young, there was Two Tone came in, which opened me up to that sort of music. I was very much into things like Specials and the Madness and people like that and Selector. Those sort of groups, and that was at a very early age. You know, I'm talking about sort of 8 years old. We got very sort of into, and of course, the fashion interested in that as well at the time. So you had things like the skiing jumpers, the flight jackets, the stay-pressed trousers, the moccasins, those Chelsea brogues, and all hand in hand with the music scene. And then I sort of moved away from that. So I got very much, I mentioned earlier on, I think, into sort of gothic punk, which was the tail end of like punk. I wasn't really into things like the Sex Pistols, but the groups like The Cure and Susan the Banshees, I was blown away by those guys. And again, I modeled myself on particularly Robert Smith. I used to dress up that way. I had all the black spiky hair, I used to put the makeup on, the smudge lipstick, and all this sort of thing. And again, back in those days, that was a head turner. I remember going on holiday with my mum and dad to Wales, and they actually made me walk on the other side of the street because people were stopping and pointing at me because they'd never seen someone dress like this. I had this great big, you know, green gothic sort of trench coat on, buckle shoes, this makeup and hair everywhere, and ears pierced, and I had crucifixes and anks and all that around my neck. And you know, my mum and dad, it was just a different time. But that was I absolutely adored that sort of music as well. And weirdly enough, that was another moment going back to when I thought about performing, if you want to call it that, is I saw I used to watch a lot of live bands. It was far more available when I was young. Sadly, you know, I feel for the youth now. And also they did smaller venues more often. You could see, you know, good groups in small venues, whereas now it tends to be stadiums and it's a different environment, different
Yes, I mean
atmosphere.
it's a different vibe. I mean, they were short notice gigs a vast majority of them. I mean, they're only sort of, simple 5 or 10 quid, which is affordable, rather than you have to have a second mortgage.
Literally, yeah.
literally. So we'll go into the a bit of a
Well,
quick.
let me just tell you this one moment, because again, it was an acting related thing as well. It was, I saw The Cure at the Guildhall in Portsmouth, which is actually quite a small venue. I saw a few bands there actually, but I remember being, I mean, you were health and safety now. You probably never, there was no seating. You were just jammed in there, and you were literally like this. You couldn't move. It was just red hot. You could just, anytime there was any crowd move, you just felt this rush of hot air coming up over your face. But anyway, the support band had been on and they were excellent as well. But suddenly it faded to black, complete pitch black. You couldn't see your hand in front of your face. And you could hear The Cure, the band, coming onto the stage. And it just went to this utter hush, which was phenomenal in itself. And then suddenly this bright white light shone from behind Robert Smith. And you just saw this silhouetted, the guitar, the hair. And they went into, which people probably won't know, their song called Primary, and it just starts with this bass line. It goes zing, ding, 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 and I was just literally got on one, and I thought, then God, I want to get on a stage somewhere and just have an audience just respond to you that way. That's the one thing about theatre you don't get with film and TV, is there's an energy from an audience. There really is, and that's priceless. It's extremely addictive as well. It's like a drug. You know, obviously you're playing your role and you're very much in the moment and in character, but you're very aware there's an energy that you can feel and pick up on, and you know, you can't sort of not be aware that there's something there. It's a phenomenal experience. And very quickly on that, I remember it's probably, I mean, one of the questions a lot of people ask is, what would you say is the best role, or the best thing you've done, if you want to say, as a professional to date? And that would probably be, I played Mercutio, who's one of my favorite sort of Shakespearean characters in Romeo and Juliet. I don't know if you've seen the Baz Luhrmann film. It's, you know, phenomenal. But anyway, I was cast as Mercutio for the Cambridge Shakespeare Company, and it was an open air in the actual University of Cambridge, in the campus there, open air, it's sort of like tableau theatres almost there. And we broke all the records for that. We had an audience of 700 people. And it was phenomenal. It really was. And just again, the energy off that audience, and particularly the nature of the show, because I'm very sort of good at stage combat. The director clearly cast me on that as well as obviously playing Mercutio. So we had this huge elaborate fight scene with me and Tybalt, and it was just absolutely phenomenal. You know, it really was. So yeah, just another little anecdote for you there.
Well, I wanted to do the next section, still continue with sort of hobbies in a broader sense, a bit of quick fire. So, what is the best concert you've been to?
That is a very hard question to answer. Wow, the best one. Cool. I've been to a few. Probably I'm gonna have to cheat and give you a couple, because it's very hard to say. One of the most impressive I ever saw was Simple Minds, and that was at the Milton Keynes Bowl. And they were absolutely outstanding, and that was the Once Upon a Time tour. And yeah, I mean, I was a huge fan of the Breakfast Club film, and the song Don't You Forget About Me kind of got me into Simple Minds. They released this album, and I bought this album, and a friend of mine said, sure. And you know, again, it was not easy, because we were only students at the time, to go to these things. One, you had to get your parents who would allow you. It's a different time now. And but anyway, went up and saw, and they were absolutely mind-blowing there, really were. They were on for about 2.5 hours, and they did all their classics, really did. And Jim Kerr, what a performer, stage presence as well. And they were so good live. You know, I think it's very hard to see people that are good live these days. But another one that I've got to say, just for a mention, I wasn't massively into them, but I did grow to love them as well, was I saw INXS at the Portsmouth Guildhall, which is because they were doing a small venues tour, and that was phenomenal. That really was, you know, again, mind-blowing. I also saw Guns N' Roses at the Milton Keynes Bowl, and that was before sort of Axl lost it. And that was outstanding as well. They were on for, again, for about 2.5 hours. It really was. So, yeah, there's a few. I could go on for hours with that, be honest with you, Marcy. But let's give you those ones, really.
So your top theatre that you've watched?
That Stephen Burkoff, Shakespeare Villains, which was quite unique. That was the sort of thing that he wrote for himself. That was really fantastic. That did blow me away. But I saw Titus Andronicus at the Globe, and that was extreme because it's an amazing play. I don't know if you know Titus. It doesn't get done very often because it's too brutal. And people are worried that they just won't go and see it because it's very, very bloody. And it's fun. And they did it at the Globe, and it was absolutely outstanding. And I also saw in Richmond, the Orange Street Theatre, I saw The Taming of the Shrew, which is another play that I really, really like. And that was excellent as well, I've got to say. That was, you know, there's three there. I tend to sort of watch the classics a bit more, sort of live theatre,
if
I can. My opinion of the classic Shakespeare. I love Shakespeare.
So I suppose the same question for TV. I mean, you've already talked about Mission Impossible. Is that your top film?
That's probably one of the hardest questions to ask because there's so many that I wouldn't even know where to start. But again, I grew up watching cowboy films. I loved, obviously, the dollar films are probably my favourites by far. And weirdly enough, the middle one is my favourite for a few dollars more. I think that's the best of the lot. And if you may be going to ask me this, favourite actors, but Gian Maria Vellante, the guy that plays is Ramon in the first one, Fistful of Dollars, and then plays El Nino in For a Few Dollars More. An Italian actor, phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal, absolutely love that guy. And he's just so intense. And that's what a performance that is in both of those. Really is outstanding. I grew up obviously watching those sort of films. Huge Star Wars fan. I mean, I was obviously young, but lucky enough to watch Star Wars at the cinema. Yes, yes. And that was quite a poignant sort of thing, in my makeup, because I sat in that auditorium in the cinema where I live now, which is now gone, unfortunately, you could hear a pin drop because we'd never seen anything like that in this country. You know, we had Doctor Who, or Blake 7, which were great shows, grew up watching those sort of, but you can see the flimsy sets and the budgets. And then you saw this production, and we heard it was coming because, again, no internet back in those days. We were aware of it arriving. I had a friend of mine that, funny enough, we'd moved over from Canada, and obviously became friends when he arrived here. And he said, "Oh, we've got to go and see this film." And I was like, "What's this on this film called Star Wars?" And seeing that, so huge Star Wars fan, arguably. One of my favourite all-time villains is Darth Maul. Not a great film, but I love that character. I think it was massively underrated, his performance, Ray Park.
But it's one of those films where the special effects have lived longer than they really should have. I mean, they're still pretty.
I still think they hold up. Yeah. In 4, 5, and 6, you know, Star Wars, Empire, Jedi, it's still incredibly watchable. 1, 2, and 3, I can deal with them now, but I remember going to the cinema, I was so excited. The CGI killed that for me. And obviously, let's not talk about Jar Jar Binks, but I can deal with them now, I think, sort of moved on. Certainly watching 7, 8, and 9, it's become something else, but the originals would always be. But, you know, that stop motion and things like that, the models, it gives it a sense of realism. CGI,
it's too clean, isn't it? You need to have the, you need to make it dirty with atmosphere.
You need dirty atmosphere, dirty sets.
Yeah.
I mean, when I did Inkheart, I was blown away by that because I walked into this set. Obviously, there's a soundstage there. It's huge. And it's an old Shepton's an old aircraft. You've got these hangars there. And this huge set. And the detail was just... And for an actor, that just gives you everything. I mean, I remember McKellen saying he was really, really disappointed about The Hobbit because he just basically was sat in, you know, blue and green screens with no one to interact. That's not what acting's about.
No,
you know, really. You need people dialogue. You need to bounce off people. You need things around you to help you to create all the time. And people argue, so you should be able to do it. But sitting in a green box is not at all You know, it's not conducive. And I think it broke Ian McKellen's heart. He was so disappointed with that. And what a fabulous actor he is.
I know. Yeah. Well, I mean, I remember was it the Two Towers? It was not really engaging at all because, you know, right at the start, there was too much CGI. You need to have that blurred bit where you... So, I mean, it is the
it's
problem.
It's very difficult. I mean, I'm a big fan of the films, I must admit. I do like them. I know what you're saying with it, but it is hard. I think Weta did a pretty good job on that as much as, but if you really, you know, you really sort of pull it apart, you can see it. But you'd never be able to make a film like that. You know, you look at Ben-Hur, the original, and Charlton Heston, they'd never be able to make that now.
No, because the money, because there's too many extras.
It's impossible. You know, to build the Colosseum again, you just wouldn't be able to do it. You know, and this is arguably what's killed, if you like, modern cinema. Modern everything is the cost of it. Video gaming. It costs ridiculous amounts of money to create a video game.
Well, some video games are on a par with some major films.
Yeah, GTA 6 will be. Yeah. It'll be a bigger budget than probably, arguably, they'll probably get that back. But they're probably the only company, Rockstar, will actually get away with that. Most sort of are just floundering now. And it's killing the industry because it takes too long to produce things like that, and they're just too expensive. And you'll see there's a new Star Wars game coming out, which I'm quite interested in, but it's retailing at about £70-80. You know, most people at video game aren't particularly affluent. They're normally people that sit around at home because they can't really afford to go out and do all these hobbies because they can't afford to do that. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it all depends on the playability and how long you can play it for, whether you can just download a new version of the game, you know, and you can play it for a long period of time, because the majority of games, you know, you finish within a week.
This is where developers get it wrong, actually, because ironically, gamers don't want. I don't want to be playing a game for 600 hours.
Yes,
it's like what I would like. I mean, Destiny is a good example of that. I enjoyed it. I didn't play Destiny when I played Destiny 2, and I enjoyed it because all my friends said, "Oh, you know, we can play together and whatever." But they just keep milking this thing, and I was on it for about 6 months because I'm what you would call an achievement or trophy whore. So I like to do all those as well because it adds to the video game for me. I play in different ways to get these trophies, achievements, and you don't have to play that way. But I was sort of it's very clever. They lock you in with this. And in the end, you go, God, I just want to play something else. And, you know, so for me, like a 30, 40-hour game is perfect. But I don't want to be spending £150 on a game like that. You know, it's too much money. But this is the sort of the cost they're sort of now bringing, because it costs them that sort of money to make them. And same with film, going back on the film industry. It's astronomical, the cost now. And it, ironically, it just kills everything for you. Football's another. I'm a great football fan. I was going to mention that in hobbies. Yes. You know, and I try and, I mean, living in London, I'd try to go. I follow two teams. I was born in Portsmouth, so I've always followed Portsmouth Football Club. But when I was a kid, they were sort of a Div 3, Div 4 team. So, like most kids, we all had another team. And very quickly, I was quite a good goalie when I was young. And my hero was a guy called Peter Benetti. I don't know if you know him. He played for Chelsea, so I've always followed Chelsea Football Club. And I lived in West London because my drama school was there. But I couldn't afford to go to Stamford Bridge all the time. There's no way. So I used to go and watch Queen's Park Rangers because it was slightly more affordable. But you look at the cost of football, they're just killing it for themselves. You know, it's just everything is just of a level now where it's just too expensive.
Well, I mean, hence why you've got more people sort of watching those clubs on the telly and then enjoying the game experience with local clubs when it's sort of 15, 20 quid to get in nowadays. Even that is quite expensive.
That's insane. I mean, I dread to think how much it is to go watch Chelsea at the moment, you know, and also see the quality of that team, but we won't go there.
They had tickets to Coventry semis and they were retailing about sort of 400 quid.
Yeah. It's wicked, insane, isn't it? It was always the working class game. It's supposed to be available to people. I mean, I remember back in the day when I was sort of growing up here and as a teenager, when I first started working, your mates would ring you up and say, you're going to football today. And you go, yeah, all right, I'll meet you down at Fratton Park. And it's a fiver through the and you just walk in there. You know, so it was very much on the fly. It was fun. You felt connected to the city, did it quite regularly. Whereas now it's a major event you have to plan for one game. And if you've got kids, how do you afford to take a family to a game like that? It's, you're looking £500 or £600. That's not what football is about. You know, it's wicked, really.
In conclusion to the hobbies, I mean, we've talked about a lot. You know, I'm interested in the books that you read. I mean, are they primarily for entertainment, or are they more of the technical side, or are they a sort of an eclectic mix of different types of genres?
Interestingly enough, yeah, I do read sort of fantasy books. I mean, love Harry Potter, those sort of things, The Hobbit, Lord of the Rings, but I've always been fascinated with history. I was naturally very good at history at school because I could visualize, you know, these incidents and what have you, what people were wearing, all this. I love going to the V&A, for instance, to see the costume and garments there.
So you've talked about a number of books through this interview. I just wanted to find out if you have a particular favourite book, or is there a range of books that you're interested in reading?
Probably more of a range, I would say. I have some favourites. Big Harry Potter fan. Enjoyed all of those. I've always liked J.K. Rowling's work. Lord of the Rings fan. The Hobbit. I remember reading that as a child and being absolutely blown away by The Hobbit. I read Shakespeare more than anything else, just to sort of keep it that sort of language fresh as well. I enjoy sort of working on Shakespeare projects if I can. So some of my favourite roles have been sort of Shakespearean characters. Mm-hmm. And outside of that, contrary to possibly the fantasy sort of thing, which I've always been interested in, I do enjoy history. I've always enjoyed history since school. And I like to read sort of history books of some description, or even sort of novels that are based sort of loosely on history with a little bit of poetic license. So I've read some books on the Templars, which aren't actually factual, but they're quite interesting to read, obviously. But the last book I read is probably the most prevalent one would be, it was called A Line in the Sand. And that's actually about the sort of division of the Arab states as we know it now.
Yes, yes.
From sort of obviously British and the French rule. And it's fascinating. And ironically, that was prior to all this chaos that's happened in Gaza with Israel. So it's even more sort of poignant for me at the moment. And then I've moved that on, and I've finished this book, and I've just picked up a book on Palestine now. Yes. And I've always had, I find with books, a lot of the times, certainly historical things, it's stimulated from films that I would watch, and obviously I understand, contrary to most people, that what you see in a film isn't probably very factual. It's very, very, very loosely based on fact. But that actually stimulates me, if I see a good film, to go and get some proper books on the subjects and just in sort of, you know, investigate a little bit more about it.
The next point I want to come on is what sort of books do you read? Is there a particular genre that you read, or is it more that particular individual book that sparks your interest?
Yeah, I've got a wide range. There's no sort of particular style of book, I would say. Always been interested in horror. I like reading horror books. One of my all-time favourites would be the classic Bram Stoker's Dracula. Mm-hmm. I'm a big Harry Potter fan. Love J.K. Rowling's work. Always read those. I read them quite regularly, actually. Go back to them. So probably once every couple of years, I'll read the series of the Harry Potter.
So do you feel that there's been quite a lot of heavy lifting of the Harry Potters with the Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit?
I think there's certainly a connection there as well. Particularly if you watch the films, you can see that kind of link with it. I mean, I think fantasy always lends itself into each other anyway. I mean, Game of Thrones is another example. I love Game of Thrones. I sadly haven't got, I'm just going to say, I'd like to get around to reading those somewhere along the line as well. But just time is obviously, like most people, a killing factor for it. So, but definitely with fantasy, there's, you can see not plagiarism, but they're certainly, they lend each other. It's, I mean, when I was a child, I was very much into, I was introduced at an early age because an American lad moved to my school and we became friends. But I don't know if you're aware of something called, it was Advanced Dungeons and Dragons.
Yes, I
So
used to play it
Nordic.
with the weird dice.
Yeah, absolutely. And this, I think, stimulated an awful lot of sort of fantasy writing, because prior to sort of, you know, Tolkien's Rings, there was stuff out there, but not like it is now. I mean, it's a genre that's just gone through the roof, and it makes great film. You know, I think a lot, many people look for escapism because the modern world is not necessarily quite the way everyone was hoping it was going to go. That's another conversation, but certainly, you know, fantasy, it, just to get out of the banal and the sort of the mundane is just a great go-to. So I tend to read those sort of books when I can. But equally, I'm fascinated with history. I always have since when I was at school. I was very good at history just because it was more a visual thing. I could sort of visualize the knights, the medieval, these sort of things, Roman history, Second World War, First World War. It was all this, you know, I found it extremely interesting. And the factual side, I've always enjoyed fact. I'm quite a real person, I think, by nature, even though I enjoy fantasy for escapism. But when it comes down to sort of like film, a film will stimulate me. So if I watch a particular film that's sort of loose, and we all know what, we hope we all know that, sadly some people don't, that films that are based on facts are very, very loosely, obviously they're supposed to be a medium of entertainment, so there's a lot of embellishment to condense a novel into a 2.5 hour segment. It's very, very difficult from a filmmaker's point of view. So there's a lot of leeway, and certainly from historical content, you know, you could be talking a period of like 30 years to get into a 2 hour segment. It's very, very difficult. So film is very loose, but it does stimulate me to go and sometimes read books and things afterwards. So yeah,
Well,
I'd
I
say.
suppose you do have to condense for a film, and you have to make the film exciting as well. So,
Yeah. People forget it. I mean, my nan was a great example. You know, I love my nan to bits, and she was went through the Second World War. My grandfather fought in the Navy on the original HMS Ark Royal. He was a chief PO. So they were from that generation. They'd seen that side of life, which we sort of hear about or read in history books. And I remember she watched a film called U571, which was about the discovery of the Enigma machine, and it's all Americans on there, and she was foaming about that, saying this never happened and all this, and I was the, I said, man, just calm down. Look, there's so much poetic license with things like this, because at the end of the day, it's an American company that made the film. They've obviously put, but the thing is, it's an interesting film because it talks about that subject, and hopefully that would stimulate. But you can't have that conversation with some people. You know, they're so adamant that it wasn't historically accurate. It's, I mean, Zulu. I love Zulu, but there's lots of flaws in that. It's a great film. I mean, Stanley Baker is one of my favorite actors, and he actually, I don't know if you're aware, he produced that film as well. So it was something, a piece of history he was very interested in. But again, you've got to try and condense that into an hour and a half, 2 hours. It's very difficult. And if you know, people don't realize that it's show business, it's a business. So there's people pumping now millions of dollars or pounds into these projects, and some of them have obviously got a vested interest in that. So they're going to push, you know, they might want to see a little bit of this. Obviously, we won't get into the woke side because that's a completely different agenda. We, you know, we won't politicize this. That's maybe another conversation. But obviously, historically, that's always been the case. So you're not going to get true facts in a film. Go and read a book if you really want to find out about it. But a lot of people just aren't interested. They take films and they start quoting them and going, oh, this is like, no, it's not. That's all. It's nowhere near actually historically accurate.
So we're moving now on to the next section. I mean, the main thing is we want to talk about food. So on the
Yeah.
next, what
Okay.
is the, I mean, I suppose best restaurant has a number of different connotations.
Yeah.
And it could be the type of food, the service, the location, special interests, special events. But effectively, taking all that into account, what is the best restaurant you have ever eaten at?
Tough question. Obviously, I'm sort of like a normal person, so I'm not extremely affluent. So obviously, money's an issue, like many people for me. So going to a restaurant is an absolute treat. So restaurant-wise, I think the most exciting one I ever went to, and it's a bit of a cop out really, because I actually worked there, was Harrods. I had a meal. I had fish and chips in Harrods, and it was fantastic. And it was, I worked there back in the day. It would be, I think, circa 2001 to about, no, it must be 2003, I think it was actually, tell a lie. And it was more of a museum then. It really was. I mean, it's all changed ownership again now. So
Course.
it's slightly different. But it was a fabulous place, fabulous environment to work in. It was phenomenal to be in there. And again, I went for a meal in the restaurant, and that was stunning. And yes, it was expensive, but the food was outstanding. I mean, obviously, I just wanted fish and chips in Harrods. I thought that was quite quirky. So I was working there, so I got some discount and what have you. But that was pretty impressive. But it's not really a restaurant, but I've always enjoyed, I like to try foods. My mum's terrible. She won't really sort of tap into anything. She'll just go for what she knows is safe. I'm quite the opposite with that. I will probably look at a menu and pick something I haven't had. And I'm not worried if I don't particularly enjoy it. I just think, well, I've tried it, you know. But generally, I do like most food. I'm a bit of a foodie. Where I used to live in West London, Acton, which is very close to Shepherd's Bush, just so sort of geographically people sort of understand that, there used to be a kebab shop there. And it was on the high street. So it's not a restaurant, although arguably you could
Yes.
sit in there and have
Well,
it.
you could
But
do, yes.
my God, their kebabs were just outstanding. Not so much the, you get the traditional sort of pita bread, which we've all seen, which is you sort of open up and they slap it all. These had this kind of like stone oven, and they would sort of hand make this pita bread, this, and then throw it on this oven. So it was like a huge wrap. And the meat, I mean, I always have like shish and things like that, so it's proper meat as opposed to doner in there and what have you. It's phenomenal, and sadly, it's shut like many of these. I was really disappointed with that, and I never got to find out what happened there because I would have one of those once a week, so that was outstanding from a food. And we'll call it a restaurant because you could, and I did sit in there a few times. You know what living in London's
Yeah,
like, it's sort of you go back to the flat to sleep pretty much, and then you're out doing whatever you've got to do, sort of thing. So that was, yeah, a good one.
so I mean, the next thing I'm interested in is what sort of what is your traditional food favorite? I mean, is it be, an example would be a Sunday roast, or is that too sort of obvious?
Well, you've nicked it because I've got to tell you this. We have this conversation a lot. I'm close to my mum and dad still. I'm not married, so obviously I've got a connection with my mum and dad. So I go and see them quite a lot. And both me and my dad have said, you know, so mum, do you want to go out? And whatever. She's not too fussed about it. And she said, do you want to go out? And we both said the same. One, the cost of going to a restaurant now is just insane. It's like going to watch Chelsea play. And be perfectly honest, she's such a fabulous cook, and she's never trained or anything. It's all been self-taught, but she's always enjoyed cooking, and she does very sort of like simple traditional dishes. So you roast, you know, she does chilies and things like that, but they're outstanding. They're honestly better than I would get in a restaurant. So my favorite would definitely be, it is the roast dinner. I'm sorry, I've just quoted you, but you've literally just said, yeah, that would be it. My mum's roast dinner is outstanding.
I mean, I've written a number of different questions about food. I mean, what I'm also interested with a lot of people is what is your favorite fruit? Is it because of the taste? Is it because it's quite easy to transport and eat? So, what is your favorite fruit to eat?
I have blueberries pretty much every day, I would say. And it's a bit of a double because one, I enjoy the flavor, the taste of them, but also I've got this thing that I read years ago that they're extremely good for you. particularly sort of like anti-cancer agents and things like that. So I would say if I had to pick one fruit that I could have, it would be blueberries. But I enjoy most fruits, to be honest with you. I mean, I like bananas. I'm very fond of apples, but particular apples. I like pink ladies.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very fond of pink ladies or Brabens. I enjoy those. I have apples a lot as well. And I enjoy Satsumas and tangerines, but I don't seem to get them very often because I find them a bit messy because I tend to eat fruit when I'm out.
Yeah.
It's at home. It's do I normally have a meal and fruit doesn't, I mean, the blueberries I'll have, but the other things, not so much. So those sort of things I tend to eat sort of on the fly. And I find things like oranges and whatever, a little bit. So I enjoy them, but I tend to leave them alone a little bit. Melon. I mean, melon's technically a fruit, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. I just checked in.
I suppose you have to forget all that.
But I enjoy melon, and again, particular watermelon. I'm not fussed on the white melons and things like that particularly. It's got to be water. I love watermelon, and that was fabulous living in London. The watermelons up there, God, the size of those last you a week.
and when you're filming, I mean, a lot of people will think that the catering on site would be fairly poor, but I mean, is there a range of different food
it's excellent.
Styles?
Yeah, it's phenomenal. I mean, I did a film called Inca. I think we talked about it earlier on years ago. And obviously it was big budget and you had A-list actors there and what have you. And you clearly have a company that comes in and does the catering, and the food was outstanding. It really was. You could have pretty much anything you wanted there. And there was, I mean, the breakfast bar was this huge spread of fruits, ironically, melons, pretty much any fruit that you wanted, kiwi, all this, down to pastries and what have you. And then they had sort of like a fairly sort of, not fixed menu, but a variety for sort of like main, and that was pastas, chilies also. And it was unbelievably good. I mean, it's their business, you know, they're in there every day. So it's extraordinarily good. I think people think it's going to be some rough burger van. Was it?
Yes, it's some perception of sort of, you know, a small range to just sort of feed the crew and feed the cast and off you start working again. But
absolutely.
I suppose.
Ironically, I mean, I will say it's interesting because you watch how people work. I personally, I'm not, when I'm actually, I've got sort of like fairly intense scenes to do. Yep. I don't actually like to eat anything. I've had people say to me, you're not going to eat anything, because I can find that having sort of just eaten, so it can be quite distracting. I get a bit sort of lethargic. I feel like I trained as a method actor. I'm not one of the nutters, but I like to, you know, really feel I'm in the character, so to speak, and become that character. And if I've just eaten a chili, the taste of that I can find quite distracting. So what I tend to sort of have in between, if I've got a big break, then it's fine. But what I would tend to have is I would just have very bland things just to sort of snack on. Like, and for instance, I would just have Walker's crisps, plain Walker's crisps, because I don't find that interferes with the process. And it gives me a little bit of energy. But do you see what I mean? It's not distracting. Yeah. I'm thinking, I've just had a steak and chips meal, and now I've got to murder someone.
I suppose, you know, you probably don't want to drink fizzy water in case, you know, you make noises from that, and you want to concentrate.
Yeah. Well, you get plenty of noises and things like that. Yeah, it's always that. But so, it's damage limitation, and everyone's got their own process. I mean, some people I've seen, you know, they just sit there and they eat a full spread and then go on and do their work. It's, you know, it works for them fine.
So is that canteen sort of effectively open 24/7, or are there special times and places where
you have meal breaks sort of thing, but pretty much if you wanted to go and get something, I mean, for instance, the breakfast thing stays there for a few hours. It's obviously off the set. So you just go over and grab yourself something. And if you wanted a coffee or something, you can ask one of the runners and they'll do it for you. You know, the runners are fabulous. They're so, so nice and helpful. And they're there to sort of pick up all these little things. You know, it's one of those. So Yeah, it's great. Being on a film set is phenomenal. I mean, TV, it's a little bit different. You still get that, but it's normally TV's smaller budgets, tighter schedules. So it's a little bit more regimented. Again, you can still, you know, if you want a coffee, you're desperate for a Starbucks, you can get one of the runners to go and grab you. But I think most decent people, you're not going to interfere with someone and be a bloody nuisance, you know.
So I'll put you in a scenario. So it's for whatever reason it's your last meal on the planet.
All right. Yeah.
Money's no object. So, and then you can make it as sort of wide ranging as possible. So, would you find somewhere completely new, or would you revisit somewhere you've already been, so you know the quality and the range of food that you're going to potentially eat?
Yeah. A last meal would definitely be a revisit. I'd want the guarantee, the safety net there. Would you like to know what it is, or?
Well, I mean we can go through that.
No, I'll leave it with you. Yeah, I was going to say I'll tell you what it was, but we'll get to that then. Yeah.
So the in well, I mean, to what time would you have it? Would it be sort of breakfast, lunch, dinner, ad
It
hoc?
would be. What would be an evening meal, dinner, if you want to call it that? Yeah, traditional to proper dinner.
And then would you arrange for
I want to
transfer?
get my money's worth. It's the
I
last one.
mean, because it's late at night, I mean, would you arrange for transport so you can drink and you wouldn't have to worry too much about taking yourself home safely?
Almost certainly, if it's the last one, there would be some drinking and some wine. So I think transport would be a very sensible idea.
And then would you have sort of make it sort of it a solo affair? Would you make it fairly intimate? So you've got one-to-one dining.
Definitely
Would you just
intimate.
have, so you wouldn't have all your friends there to say that
Yeah,
they could
100%. If it's the last, you know, I know you said last minute. I'm thinking sort of in my head, last day on earth. I feel like I'm on death row. So.
And then, I mean, would you want to be fairly relaxed? Would you want to be suited and booted or somewhere in between?
Interesting. I think if it was the, again, I'm thinking last day on earth as opposed to last meal.
Yes, yeah.
Last, if it was just, you know, the last meal, it's a bit of a sort of abstract almost questioning
Yes,
that.
yes, yes.
So I'm going to go with like it's my last day on earth, so it's my
Yeah,
last
yeah,
meal.
yeah.
I probably would want to dress up actually. I've always enjoyed, again, as an actor, I think we play dress up pretty much all the
Yeah,
time. I
yes.
mean, for instance, when I go out with my friends, I'll always normally wear quite a what I call a funky shirt, quite a ridiculous looking shirt, you know, flowery, big collars, all this, a jacket. Other times I'll go sort of, I used to be into all the two-tone things, so I'll put on Fred Perry and those sort of things and wear brogues and what have you. So no, I'd want to dress up. Yeah, I definitely want to dress up for it.
So would you be in a particular character or just sort of traditional attire?
I think I'd like, I mean, I'm fascinated with Victorian garb. I've always enjoyed smock, that kind of thing. I think I'd go that sort of direction. So, as a reference, I'd look probably a little bit like Lawrence Llewellyn Bowen, that sort of thing.
Then
Yeah.
would you have a starter? Or would you just sort of avoid that and just go straight for a main course?
Well, knowing where I'm going, with it, I think starter would be interfere with the main, just because of, and you'll find out when you get to that question, the volume. So I'd probably leave the starter, maybe have a small glass of wine. How's that as a starter?
And then I suppose after we've gone for the main, then we can talk more about the wine. So, what sort of main meal would you go for? I mean, would you go for a really good sort of Sunday lunch, or do something? Sorry, Sunday dinner, or what would you choose?
Very easy for me, and I can be extremely specific with it. I would have my mother's Christmas dinner, which is a roast dinner, and it's turkey, proper turkey meal. It's phenomenal. I've never, every year, it's, you know, just makes Christmas for us. It's my mum's birthday on Christmas Day, so it's a huge event. Well, I know it's quite, funny enough, mine's on the 28th, so 3 days after. So Christmas has always been a huge, huge thing for us all the way through, you know, all our lives, really. It's a massive celebration because the two birthdays and obviously Christmas itself. So we go a bit silly, really, with it. But that meal is outstanding. And she does everything. You've got the roast potatoes, mashed potatoes done with cream, asparagus with a hollandaise sauce, the turkey, the gravy is phenomenal, made with white wine, chestnut stuffing, pigs in blankets, sprouts, sometimes some green as well to go with it. I mean, basically, she's running out of room on the plate to put it. That's why I wouldn't have a starter, because it would just interfere with parsnips. You know, again, it's absolutely outstanding, and I would 100% have that every time. You know, I look forward to it whenever I go home. I go, oh, any chance we're going to have a turkey or something like that?
So in the past, what sort of red wine would you have? Would it just be sort of table wine, or would you go for something specific?
With turkey, I'd probably have a white wine. But red wine, I do. I mean, I actually love red wine. I think it sort of varies. I mean, I like Chianti. I've always been very, very fond of Chianti. I find it very, very easy to drink and very pleasing. And there's a smoothness about it as well. But equally, I'm quite happy with just you know, sometimes I find some of the rougher wines, like French table wines. I quite enjoy, you know, I'm a man, so I quite enjoy that sort of like harshness as well. But if I was going to say, I'd say Chianti, but it was probably the last one I was going to have. Although I've just tried recently, which is, I think it's called 12 Crimes. It's an Australian brand, which has got, again, being a bit sort of actory, I picked up on the label, which has got these sort of like, you know, Victorian kind of criminals on the thing. I thought, oh, that looks interesting. I don't know anything about a wine. And they're actually really nice, I have to say. Some of them are aged in, I think, oak and sort of whiskey oak barrels, and there's quite an edge to those. So one of those would be nice, definitely.
So after finishing this huge meal and maybe having a bit of rest to wait for the stomach to digest, so you can have a little bit more room, would you have a sort of a traditional pudding or a dessert? Or I mean, what sort of, I mean, maybe we're going with the same theme as the main, but if you could let me know about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if it was my last again, I'd go away from the theme this time, because I have a huge penchant for rice pudding.
Yes.
And my mum makes a fabulous rice pudding, and her secret, so if any foodies are on here, and it's probably well known, but I wouldn't really know where to start. I mean, I can eat any rice pudding, love it, from Ambrosia to Tesco's budget, what have you, but the homemade ones are phenomenal. Her secret is to use carnation milk. So I don't know if you've ever heard of that at all.
Yes.
And it just lifts it. It's so creamy. But a homemade rice pudding would definitely fit the bill.
So would you have any accoutrements to that? Like maybe some...
No cinnamon, nothing like that at all. Absolutely not. No, just raw. Absolutely raw and wriggling, as Andy Serkis used to like to say. So it's, just so I can... it's interesting you pick up, just on a foodie thing, because I watch other people eat, and for instance, whatever meal, they'll tend to, so say chili, they'll pick up the meat and they'll pick up a bit of pasta and they'll put it in there. Or with a roast in it, they'll cut a little bit of meat and they'll cut a little bit of sprout maybe. But I've never liked that. I like to actually taste the individual thing. So I would only ever eat a sprout.
Yeah.
I'd only ever eat a piece of meat. I'd only ever eat a bit of potato. I never sort of like amalgamate those things. I find it sort of jars with the flavour. It's only a personal thing. But I've watched other people that sort of do it. And I think I would find that a bit confusing.
Yeah.
So to answer your question with the rice pudding, no, I would just have it as rice pudding, because I wouldn't want things to interfere with that sort of flavour, you know. That's just a personal sort of taste, I suppose. Excuse the pun.
So would you follow that off with a beer, a coffee, a tea, or an aperitif?
Well, again, last day on our last meal, I'd be looking at trying to tap into all those senses. And again, I'd love Coca-Cola, but only real Coca-Cola.
Okay.
I'm not a fan of Pepsi. I know it's ridiculous. I don't know how many people, but I'm quite anal about that. For instance, if I ever went into a shop and they didn't have Coke, then I just wouldn't bother. I couldn't buy a Pepsi and go, okay, I'll have a Pepsi instead. It's got to be the real Coca-Cola. I just love the flavour. So I'd probably have a tin of Coke just to get that sort of taste and for a last time and wash that down. But I definitely want to finish with a cup of tea because I'm a dreadful tea fiend. I'd probably drink 30 cups of tea a day.
So is this herb tea or builder's
no,
tea?
No, traditional, yeah, traditional black tea. Yeah, your average standard. I like the Yorkshire tea. I'm quite into that. So something with a bit of strength. I quite like my tea sort of strong but milky as well. And I'm not. I've never really been into the herbal teas. Green tea, I can sort of do. But again, I think if someone offers me a cup of tea and I say, "Oh, do you want a raspberry? Or do you want no? Just a normal tea, please."
So that comes at the end of the meal. But if you could talk to a younger self, what would you tell them to make their life more enjoyable, potentially more easier? Maybe they're sort of starting out on a new journey, maybe around sort of 18 or 25.
That is a tough one. I would probably say, it's a bit cliche, but be true to yourself. And what I mean by that is follow your instincts. Don't let other people sort of push you in directions that you sort of deep down know that that's not really the way you want to go. And again, I think we discussed this earlier on, probably like yourself, Mark. I was from a generation when things weren't quite as available as it is now. To have those conversations with your peers and your family would just be poo-pooed. It's don't be ridiculous. You know, why do you want to be an actor? Who does that sort of thing? And it could be anything. Why do you want to be a musician? I would say follow your dreams. I know it's all cliche, but there's a lot of truth in it as well. And I suppressed doing things that I wanted to do because other people would probably have not looked very kindly on it and put a little bit of pressure. And it's not a form of weakness. I think when you're young, you go along with people and you want to be liked and all this sort of thing. I would say ignore all that and do what you want to do from an early age, and push yourself all the time. And it will make you happy. I mean, I've had some god-awful jobs outside of acting, and I don't last very long of them because I've always been of a mind that I want to be happy. And I can't think of anything worse than going into a vocational or daily grind that you absolutely hate, because those hours that you're there, you will never get back.
No, no, no.
So even if you're not doing the job that you want to do, you've got to find something. Everyone's got to earn money and pay their way, but you've got to find something that you can get out of bed for and go, okay, well, I'll go and do this. It's bearable. And then hopefully, you know, follow your dream somewhere along the line. Does that answer the question?
It does.
Tough question. That's the hardest question to answer by far.
And the last question, I mean, is there any question that I should have asked that I haven't?
No, I think you've covered pretty much most of it, really. It's, you've covered previous circumstances. I think you've done a good job. Yeah.
Okay. So thank you very much, actor.
The only other thing you could say is, do you ever want to get married? Have you got kids? But I think we've already mentioned that. No, I'm not married. And I don't have children. So I have a cat. That's enough for me. I love my cats.
Okay, I think that is the end of the interview. Thank you very much for your time.
Brilliant. No, it's a pleasure to meet you, and I wish you well. Thank you, Martin.
Thank you. You take care. Thank you very much. Cheers.
Bye-bye. Bye. Thank you.